Thank you, Mr. Henderson, and good afternoon to you all and to the Meadville congregation, too. This was one of the two Sabbaths this month where, despite the best efforts of our deacon in place, Bruce Courtney, we were unable to obtain a suitable meeting hall for Meadville. So they are listening online today. That's why there was an announcement for services for them next week. So we were unable to get the same hall that we used last week, the Active Aging Senior Center. Apparently, we all aged too much to be able to go there this past week, so we will hope to go back there by the Sabbath after the feast. We'll be at the community center you heard about for the rest of the time before the feast. Looking ahead, those of you who are planning to attend Orange Beach for the feast, if you haven't already discovered it, at least for the time being, the state of Alabama has been removed from Ohio's suggested quarantine list. As of this past week, on Thursday, there are now just four states that the governor's office is suggesting Ohio residents or visitors from these states coming to Ohio, suggesting a 14-day quarantine. There are just Mississippi, Florida, Idaho, and Nevada. I'm unclear as to the rate of the difficulties in Idaho and Nevada. I think it's mainly a metric involving the percentage of tests positive of those that have been performed. But many of the states, the percentages are dropping. In fact, New York State, which of course was one of the hot spots early, the test percentage is now down to between 1 and 2% of those that are being tested. So that's certainly good to hear, and we hope that it continues in that direction. But I thought those of you going to Orange Beach would like to hear that. Texas is also off the list. That involves Kerrville as well, so any attendees there would have the same issue. Last week's sermon turned out to be something of a continuing pattern in the messages that I've given lately. I spoke of last week's message being number 5 in a progression. In reviewing the titles and descriptions that I've given to Autumn Smith, who handles posting the messages online for us on our cleveland.cogwa.org website. But a closer look and a bit of thinking reveals something just a little bit more, I think. I don't think it's just messages from one person. And I don't think it's messages given in just one area or even one congregation or one circuit. I can see similarities in the messages given by other men here in sermons or split sermons. There have certainly been some overlaps and overtones that are the same. There is a basic focus on the centrally important issues in our lives right now. There are messages on related topics of encouragement and staying unified in our outlooks as brothers and sisters in the calling God's given us. And I suspect that in other church areas, other pastors and elders are finding their minds turning to similar themes in recent messages they've given as spiritual nourishment to their congregations too. I doubt seriously if that is a coincidence. So where does the trail lead today? That's the question. Last week I asked you the question, how does your garden grow? The subject was dealing with the wrong kind of crop, weeds, spiritual weeds, or what the Bible calls a root of bitterness. Today I'd like to stay in the same general vicinity. Let's stick with horticulture while we're at it. Because come January, we won't be able to pay any attention to what's growing out in the garden for sure. So let's begin with some private instruction Jesus Christ gave his disciples the night before he died. We read this and related passages and other chapters nearby every year at the Passover. I'm taking you first of all to John 15 today. John chapter 15, and we'll start in verse 1. And right away we have an example of something that grows. Verse 1 says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. My understanding is that every one of the 50 states in this country has at least one vineyard, active vineyard, producing vineyard. I'm not sure where they are in some states. I doubt, for example, that there's much development in Death Valley, California. I think you better go to Napa and Sonoma for that. But every state has something. Some of Ohio's best-known wines are in the Northeast, along Lake Erie. And especially some of the white wines, the Pinot Grigios and some of those Chardonnays, are quite good. They're quite well done. There's a lot in these passages. As you read through, every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I've spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and he's withered. They gather them and throw them into the fire and they're burned. And if you abide in me and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire and it shall be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit. So you will be my disciples. This is a well-known analogy, and we read it, as I've said, every year at the Passover for sure. First, though, I think there are a couple of perhaps little noticed points. They may not tie as directly in immediately to what we're focusing in at the Passover, so maybe we missed them. Jesus himself is the true vine, but where does the Father appear in this comparison? Well, he is the vine dresser, according to Jesus. The Father is the one who prunes and trims the branches. But ask yourself a question. What pruning does Jesus Christ need? And the answer, of course, is none. He was the only perfect human being. The only one. He doesn't need any pruning. Who needs the pruning? You and I. We need it to be truly fruitful. And as we read at the last part of this quotation, at least verse 8, by this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, so you will be my disciples. You and I need to go through a little bit of pain now and then to be totally productive. Jesus Christ, we're told, even learned by the things that he suffered. He didn't have to have dead spots trimmed off. There was nothing spiritually dead about him anywhere. But he still learned by the things he suffered. And we'll get into something related to that in the rest of the message. We're the ones who need the pruning. When Christ tells us that he is the vine, we come into the picture, in effect, as branches that are grafted in, to use an analogy that Paul used in the book of Romans with those who were Gentile Christians. But we are branches growing and so attached that we depend on the nourishment spiritually that is only available because he is rooted. That's the only place we receive the nourishment we need, because of his connection to the Father and the rootedness that he has in the plan that they've made from the beginning. Verses 4 and 5 talk about that. Abide in me and I in you. He says, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. And reminds them again, I am the vine, you are the branches. So where does that leave us? Well, look at verses 6 and 8. If anyone does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and is withered. They gather them and throw them into the fire and they're burned. Verse 8, by this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit. If you do that, you'll be my disciples. That's what we need to be thinking about. This example is pretty specific. Vines that bear fruit. We think of grapes and the fruit that comes from them. If you've ever walked through a beautifully producing vineyard, it's a beautiful sight. We had the opportunity at one feast a number of years ago in California to actually have a dinner activity at a winery with various samplings of the wine that they grew there. It wasn't so much of a tasting where, you know, you had to taste and spit. They didn't provide that. You just had a little sample, a little sip that you could take during the meal of several different types. Maybe I shouldn't say several. Well, I know they had a white and a red anyway. Let's leave it at that. But let's develop the same general idea in a bit broader terms. Because as you know, fruit can describe any yield of just about any crop. Certainly biblically, that analogy is there. For instance, turn back to the book of Luke, to Luke chapter 8. And here's a very familiar parable. The parable of the sower that Jesus used to teach. It also deals with fruit or agricultural production. Pick it up in verse 5. A sower went out to sow his seed. And as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trampled down, and the birds of the air devoured it. Some fell on rock, and as soon as it sprang up, it withered away because it lacked moisture. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. Others fell on good ground, sprang up, and yielded a crop, 100-fold. When he had said these things, he cried, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Then his disciples asked him, saying, "What does the parable mean?" And he said, "To you it has been given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God." That would be a common phrase that Paul would use later in his ministry, as we know, in his letters. "But to the rest it is given in parables, that seeing they may not see, hearing they may not understand." That's what happens if a person's mind is not opened. Now the parable is this. The seed is the word of God. Those by the wayside are the ones who hear. Then the devil comes and takes the word away out of their mouths, out of their hearts, lest they should believe and be saved. But the ones on the rock are those who, when they hear, receive the word with joy, and these have no root, who believe for a while, and in time of temptation they fall away. Luke's wording is just a little bit distinct from the account in Matthew and Mark, the other two synoptic gospels, and that's why I came here. Now the ones that fell among the thorns are those who, when they have heard, go out and are choked with cares and riches and pleasures of life, and they bring no fruit to maturity. Even that's interesting. It just says they bring no fruit to maturity. Have you ever had a plant that grew? Maybe you put it in the ground a little too late and it just seemed like it was very slow growing and the frost got it before you did? Frustrating, isn't it? It must be frustrating to God too. But the ones that fell on the good ground are those who, having heard the word with a noble and good heart, keep it and bear fruit with patience. That's the unique part for Luke's account. Matthew and Mark don't use the phrase "with patience." And that's what I wanted to talk about today. That's where I want to go today. Patience. Do you and I have some pruning to do in certain areas of our lives? I imagine we do. I know I do. I'm guessing most of you do too. First of all, the New Testament uses two basic words in Greek that deal with the idea generally of patience. Hupomone is one, H-U-P-O-M-O-N-E, and macrothumia is the other. That's not as opposed to microthumia, it's just macrothumia, M-A-K-R-O-T-H-U-M-I-A. The first one, hupomone, and the various variations of it, whether noun form hupomone is, verb is hupomino, and others, that's the one that's used here in Luke chapter 8. It comes from two words in Greek, meaning separately, to abide and under. To abide under. In other words, it carries the connotation of bearing up under a load. And it carries the connotation of endurance. And sometimes it's translated that way in the New Testament and English that we have. Sometimes upomone is translated endurance. Run with endurance the race that is set before you. We find in Hebrews 12 and so other places. The second word, macrothumia, is often translated as long-suffering. For example, in 2 Peter 3:9, we've read many times where it says that God is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. He's long-suffering, and that's pretty much just what it means. It means someone who is willing to suffer long. What's interesting to me is that these two kinds of patience that are talked about, one of them is used primarily when we have to deal with what we would call the trials of life. Things that happen, some of them may be self-induced. We know that. I talked about that in a sermon not too long ago as well. The concept of bitterness just last week about the reaction. Sometimes if we don't get what we hoped to see happen, if we are at fault, we are sad and regretful. But if we think somebody else knifed us in the back, we can get bitter. So we talked about that last week. But the second kind, just beyond the trials of life, is most often used, interestingly enough, when you have to be patient with other people. It's even used that way in 2 Peter 3:9 when it's talking about God. Even God has to be long-suffering. Because what does it say? He is long-suffering toward us. Meaning all humans, not willing that any should perish. That's not his desire. He doesn't want to see anybody miss out on a future in his family with him. He wants to be joined by the whole human race who have ever lived in his family. That would be his best deal scenario. Best case scenario. It's ironic, isn't it? That's the one that is often translated in the Bible as long-suffering, and even God suffers long with us. How are we doing in both categories? 1 Corinthians 13 is the love chapter. That's no surprise to anyone here. The love chapter. And as you might expect, it deals with both kinds of patience. Let's just read verses 4 to 6. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 to 6. And then we'll go on just a little bit further. But verse 4 says, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. Love is not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked. It thinks, or some translations have, imputes no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Now let me stop there for a moment. Which type of patience do you think verses 4, 5, and even verse 6 a little bit is talking about? Well, I suggest that it's talking mostly about macrothumia. About long-suffering, about putting up with other people and the difficulties that we sometimes have in interpersonal relationships. It's not always easy to deal with other people, especially if, as in our minds we define it, they just don't think the right way, which translated means just like I think. And then we have a little trouble with them. If they would only think right, we'd all get along just fine. Meaning, like me. What about the next few verses? Verse 7. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Now, perhaps some aspects of that could be dealing with other human beings. But that has a different feel to it, doesn't it? It has a different feel, especially when it says, bears all things. That sounds a lot like to abide under. to carry a load sometimes. It focuses more on hupomone, not macrothumia. Of course, the tip-off is in the last part of verse 7 when it says, endures all things. Endures all things. You know, the thing is, bearing fruit spiritually is going to mean for you and for me, brethren, that we need them both. We need them both. But in some ways, especially the endurance kind of patience. How many times have you and I read Matthew 24 and verse 13? He who endures to the end, the same shall be saved. That's sort of a catchphrase for all of us in God's church, because we understand that salvation is not something that is just accomplished in a few seconds of somehow dedicating yourself or giving your heart to the Lord, as it's sometimes phrased. That's not what it means to be saved. There is one aspect of salvation that is at a specific point in time. When we are baptized and we are given God's Holy Spirit by the laying on of hands, we've started on the path. That's the beginning point. That's the starting line. And so, yes, there is that one aspect of salvation that occurs at that one time. But it has to go on beyond that, doesn't it? It has to go on much beyond that. In fact, it has to go on for the rest of our lives. Some have a very little time. I think the person who was the oldest at the time of baptism that I ever baptized as a minister was a little 83-year-old lady in Ottawa, Ontario. And her life was interesting. By the time I met her, she was living in a senior home. And her husband had just died. They had just celebrated 60 years of marriage. And he was gone. And she began reading things to try to fill her time more. And she came across some of the publications from the church. This was back in the days of the Worldwide Church of God. Things like the Plain Truth magazine and different booklets. And she called and asked for a visit. So my wife and I visited her, and one of the things, it was immediately obvious that she had a good grasp of what she was reading. But one of the questions she asked was, why would God call me now? And I looked at her and I said, well, Mrs. So-and-so, I could tell you the name, but she's long gone now, of course, because this was about 35 years ago. Otherwise, she'd be about 118 right now. But I said, I can't answer that specifically. But it's obvious to me, and I believe it is to my wife, that God is calling you. You came out of a background of mainstream Christianity. You observed Christmas all your life. You kept Sunday all your life. And now you're launching out and doing things that you've never done before. And with a joyful heart. She was a pleasure to have around. She lived 3 years after that point, died at age 86. And I didn't have the answer to why did God call me now, except that it was His decision. And she did serve faithfully for the rest of her life. That's all God asked of her. Others are called much younger, but still don't have much more time than that. I witnessed that in my own family life growing up. My mother was called at the age of 40. She died at 43. She had 2.5 years. But it was the rest of her life. That's what God asks of us. And so, 1 Corinthians 13 is about both kinds. Bearing fruit means we'll need both. It means exactly the kind of patience that is most tested, the endurance part, in trials that seem to extend longer than we hoped for. Do you know of any trial that you've ever heard of in your life, in the approximate range we're in, where we're all sharing in the same trial, that is lasting longer than we hoped for? I think so. Does that speak to us? It does tie into last week's message, by the way, about spiritual weeds like bitterness, for example, because we know that bitterness can result when we blame others for something that ended up going wrong in our lives. We could do that in this situation. We could say, well, it started in Wuhan, China, so it must be those Chinese. They must have done something. Yeah, they got a virus. It doesn't really matter at this point how they got it. What are we going to do about it? you and I now have to endure and suffer long in cases like that. Can we do that? With God's help, I believe we can. Let me get back to the garden concept. Last week, I told you we had a mystery squash in our garden. It has gotten longer than it was last week when I spoke to you. I'm sure it's pushing 12 or 13 feet now from where it came out of the ground. Thankfully, it has not, climbed in through the window into the dining room or anything. And the mystery is finally seeming to be resolved. We're pretty sure that the blossoms have fallen away in a few places, and there are little tiny squash that are growing that appear to be butternut squash. So we're going to have, apparently, a decent number of butternut squash. Now, there is one thing that's better than zucchini, because nobody has ever grown a zucchini plant that has a decent number of zucchini on it. It always yields a bumper crop. There's something about zucchini that you never get just a few that you would like. And of course, we make the mistake in the spring. We think, let's see, should I plant one hill of zucchini or 14? And it doesn't matter. You get the same number whether you plant one or 14. They just take over the place. And if you don't pick them on exactly the right day, the next day they are the size of a small torpedo. I mean, that's just the way it works. I told you this was about gardening. But what's the point about the whole analogy? We had to wait what seemed like too long a time to figure out what kind of produce this mystery squash was going to be. And we really had no idea because we didn't plant the seeds. They were in the ground from something we had put just from sort of composting in the garden area. And my wife say, "Honey, can you throw this out in the garden? It seems like we don't need to throw it in the trash." Okay, get the shovel, dig it, put it in the ground. Next spring, see what comes up. It makes the garden planting a lot easier. We've discovered that. You just put stuff in the year before, and whatever comes up, comes up. We'll see what we've got. We know we've got some potatoes in there somewhere, and then with the mystery squash. Godly patience in life, in trials especially, is the same way. It seems to take a long time. Turn to Galatians chapter 6. Galatians 6, verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap, even if he doesn't know what he was sowing because he threw it out with the garbage to be in the compost pile. It still is going to come up. Whatever you put in the ground, that's what it's going to come up as, even if you don't know what it is. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. Too many people in our world don't know what they're sowing. They threw the seeds in the ground in the compost pile of life, and they have no idea what's going to come up. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And notice verse 9, let us not grow weary while doing good. For in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. I've always enjoyed track and field. I used to run distance races. I wasn't that good. But, finishing third or fourth was a really good day for me in a track meet. But I enjoyed the sport. One of the saddest things that I can think of seeing in that kind of an event is if someone trips and falls flat just before the finish line. It's not uncommon with races like the hurdles, for obvious reasons. Whoever designed the hurdles race had to have been a little bit sadistic, I think. But it's just painful to watch, even if you're not the one who's doing the face plant on the track. But brethren, we have to keep going if we don't lose heart. The surrounding verses show how it could connect to the other kind of patience in being long-suffering and dealing with other people. Look at verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. And if you read the early part of the chapter, verses 1, 2, and 3, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Don't think you're beyond being tested. And I shouldn't do the same. I shouldn't either. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks himself to be something, when he's nothing, he deceives himself. We have a lot of deceived people in our world. A lot. And a great number of them are deceived because they don't have a realistic self-image. They think of themselves far too highly than would be justified. Winston Churchill is reputed to have made a comment about an opposing politician. He was known for his rather sharp tongue sometimes. He said, Mr. So-and-so is a very modest man, and he has a great deal to be modest about. Maybe you have to think about it for a little bit. Well, we need to practice our patience quotient. How's it doing? How's your patience quotient doing in both categories? Mine still needs work. I am quite ready and willing to admit that. How about yours? I've already mentioned it, but once again, Matthew 24:13 is sort of the defining description of what our calling is all about when it says, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. What led Jesus Christ to make this general statement? If you look at the verses just before verse 13, you see some things. There's a lot to process here. Pick it up in verse 4. We know that he was sitting on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him and asked him some questions. And Jesus answered and said to them, Matthew 24:4, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying I am the Christ, and they will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. Most of these things are also echoed in Revelation. Not all of them, but most of them. And all these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation, and they will kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Those are not words we like to read. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. A lot of what's happening in our world has exposed the thin veneer of civilization in what we have been pleased to call a civilized world. There are some incomprehensible things going on. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. He's detailing all kinds of testing and trying situations. And then the summation is, but he who endures abides under to the end shall be saved. Now, the other question that comes up as we read some of these words would be the way that Jesus Christ defines things. We read words about his return. Some of those passages even indicate that it's not very far off. What does that mean to him? If he says it's going to be soon, what does that mean to him? It may mean one thing to us. Some of us came into the church at a time where we thought we would have long been in the millennial reign of Christ by now. But we're not. He's still not here. Does it change our responsibilities any? No. But it gives an added meaning to abiding under and enduring to the end. We have to remember the passages in Isaiah about my thoughts are not your thoughts, and in Peter as a day is a thousand years, and keep it in perspective. Where do we turn to keep all that in the forefront of our minds? Turn to James chapter 5. This is a good place to go. And just slow down and read it and think about it. James chapter 5. In verse 7, he starts into a bit of a separate topic from what he had opened the chapter with, although we know that chapter breaks were put in there by Bible scholars and organizers, humans, in other words. Verse 7, therefore, be patient, brethren. There we get hit with that patient thing again. Be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. How long do I have to be patient? There's our answer. Until the coming of the Lord. After that, it's okay to be impatient. I don't think so. We're still going to have to be patient because then we will be working with human beings. And remember the part about long-suffering? We'll still have to deal with that even once we are in God's family as spirit beings. We will still be suffering long with human beings for 1,000 years and then beyond that into the great white throne judgment period. And beyond that, well, let's just stick around and see what it's all about. We don't have a whole lot of detail of the beyond that. Be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. Look at these verses, each one by itself. Does this verse make us slow down in our mental rush just to read it? It should. Two variations of the word patient are there. There's also patiently. There's be patient and waiting patiently. Even waiting carries the connotation of time. Both are from hupomone or abiding under. It's not easy to wait patiently. Oh, it's easy to sit at the light behind the driver who's waiting when the light has gone green, drum your fingers on the wheel. That's easy to do. How about waiting patiently? Verse 8, same word. You also be patient. And then he follows up with an instruction. Another one. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. That's what I meant when I said if he says things like soon or at hand or not far away, let's have a little perspective on what that means to the one who inspired these words. James wrote those words in the first century. We're reading them in the 21st. Hasn't happened yet. The Phillips translation of the New Testament translates that phrase, establish your hearts, in a rather interesting way. It says this, so must you be patient, the first part of the verse, resting your hearts on the ultimate certainty. Interesting way of putting it. So must you be patient, resting your hearts on the ultimate certainty. And where does James go with that? For the coming of the Lord is at hand. By whose reckoning? Again, we could ask. Clearly, it's God's reckoning, because James wrote almost 2,000 years ago. Can we learn to focus on God's timetable a bit more in all these things? The holy days help us every year just to remind us of the general pattern, but they don't tell us when the things will happen. We can tell from past events, we know when the events that Passover portrays happened. AD 31. There are a number of reasons why that's the only thing that works out on the calendar. We won't go into that for now. What about putting sin out of our lives? Well, that's an ongoing process. What about being God's first fruits? Same comment. That's an ongoing process. And there was at one historical point in time when God's Holy Spirit was given to the church. But when we shift to the fall, we're looking ahead. The Feast of Trumpets portrays an event that we are closer to than we've ever been before, but that doesn't tell us how close. And you and I, being impatient, always seem to want to know how close, how soon, when. Would it change your life if you knew? What if you had a dream tonight? And in your dream, Jesus Christ sat on the edge of your bed and started talking to you. Now, I don't know how you would know it was Jesus Christ because we don't know exactly what he looked like. What if he started talking to you and said, "You, I'll just say you, I've decided I'm going to reveal to one person in the world when my return is. And you're the one." I don't know about you, but I think in my dream I'd be saying, "Why me, Lord?" But some of his servants have done that, as we know. But even so, what would it change? What would it change? We sometimes wonder things like that. There's more good stuff here. Verse 9. Here's an interesting insert. "Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." See, that's what I meant when I said, how would it change your life? If we knew or we don't know, what difference does it make? According to Jesus Christ and what he revealed through Matthew and Mark, he said it would make a difference to some people because he said, some people will say, "My Lord delays his coming." In other words, some people, if they knew it wasn't going to be soon, would live differently. You and I can't do that. We simply can't go there. This sounds like that other word for patience, macrothumia. How do we react with other people? Are we long-suffering? Can we do that? Verse 10, more good stuff. "My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure." We're going to look at the lives of some of those servants of God from the past who have gone before us and who've already demonstrated endurance and long-suffering. Then he follows up in verse 11, "We count them blessed who endure." Why? What condition are they in now? They're blessed. Why? How? Because their race is won. Remember the psalm that says, "Precious in the sight of the Eternal is the death of his saints." Why? Because they're sealed. It's all done. Now, we shouldn't be seeking death. We should be seeking to become more and more like Jesus Christ in whatever time he gives us. But then once that time is up by his determination, he says that's a special moment for him. And what is it all connected to? Read it. "You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and you have seen the end intended by the Lord." What is the end intended by the Lord? Well, brethren, it's to be in his family, isn't it? To share as co-heirs, co-inheritors with our older brother, our elder brother, Jesus Christ, and be in the family of God forever. And we don't really know entirely what that means, other than time won't exist as we know it. I can't wrap my mind around that. Everything I know is connected to time. If you and I were to stop time right this minute, did you know that you would be sitting here listening to this sermon for the rest of eternity? That's a scary thought. But time is what keeps all the other little events in our lives from running into each other, if you look at it like that. It gives us life, but it takes it away at the same time. I don't know what it's like to not be governed by time. But I sure hope to find out one day, if that's an appropriate way to express it, one day. He says, "You have seen the end intended by the Lord, and you've seen that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." He is, in fact, as Peter said, long suffering. That's our example. Think on this whole section for a while. Go back over it, read it, meditate about it, pray about it. In the meantime, let's take the advice that James gave us to take the prophets as an example. He specifically mentioned Job. Let's not focus just for now on the things God showed Job he needed to overcome. Let's focus on a couple of really outstanding good points about Job. Turn back to the book that bears his name. Job chapter 1. Of course, Job also is a very helpful book. It reveals a lot about the spirit world to us that we wouldn't have known otherwise. It reveals quite a bit about Satan. Something else that reveals quite a bit about Satan was Mr. Horchak's Friday Night Live this week, last night. It was truly outstanding. If you have not seen it yet, I strongly urge you to watch it. You can watch it online. Of course, if you've got Roku, you've got that with all the archives. Excuse me, but you can watch it online. Just go to the members page, members.cogwa.org. You'll have to click on the link for Cogwa TV live webcast because it's still current. And if you just go to Friday Night Live, you'll see what the next one is supposed to be in October. Well, that's really not going to help us much. Anyway, Job, chapter 1, verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came among them. And the Eternal said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So he answered and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Eternal and says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, his possessions have increased, he's a multimillionaire, he wants for nothing. What's not to like about that? But now, if you stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, he will surely curse you to your face." That's a pretty bold statement for Satan to make to God. He will surely curse you to your face. Satan is brilliant, but there seem to be some things he can't read. And most of them have to do with God's righteousness, because that's foreign to him. It's foreign to him. A lot of things are like that. Other times of history are like that. I read a quote the other day from Leslie Harley, a British novelist of the last century. And he said, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." I think that's something to mull over. I'll certainly be mulling over it and working on the assignment for the church history class at FI. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. God's mind is a foreign country to Lucifer, to Satan. He does things differently. Now there was a day, Satan, it says, when the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. They killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." You notice what Satan did? There was one survivor in every catastrophe. That is a particularly fiendish way of doing things. While he was still speaking, another came and said, and I like the way this was portrayed many years ago in the Bible story by Basil Wolverton. He talked about Job was sitting there just stunned, trying to absorb it all. And he portrays it, he writes it as if he suddenly became aware that another of his servants was standing there wildly gesticulating in front of him, and the thought struck him that the only thing he hadn't heard anything about yet was his family. Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they're dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. This was a catastrophe of a level we can't even absorb. I don't think most of us. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there." In other words, I came into this life one way, and I'll leave it the same way. The Eternal gave, the Eternal has taken away. Blessed be the name of the ever-living one. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. The rest of the book portrays the story of the process Job went through to build the patience for which he is famed, for which he is noted. And it was quite a process. For a week, his friends came and sat and said nothing. Then they opened their mouths, and that was the mistake. And Job, of course, was stunned and reacted in a stunned fashion, as you might expect. But in doing it all, in going through it all, he came to an awareness. And as we know, by the end of the book, in Job chapter 42, when God actually spoke directly to him and held him to account. Verse 1 of Job 42, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'I know that you can do everything, that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Now I understand on a level I never could have before, and part of it came through abiding under. Part of it came through enduring unspeakable trials. Therefore, he doesn't blame God at all. Just like he started in chapter 1, verse 22. I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. I will not compare myself to you. I will not compare myself to other humans. I will instead say, I need your forgiveness.'" Brethren, that's a path of patience. How about some other powerful examples? What about Jacob? Go back to Jacob. Genesis 29. Genesis 29. I won't really read through the first 15 verses, just sort of skim through them. Jacob leaves home, he flees after he has been given the blessing by his father and obtained it in a rather suspicious manner, as we know. He comes to a well in a certain land. He sees a well in the field. He's had this encounter before God with his vision of what seemed to be what they call Jacob's ladder. Angels transferring back and forth, and promised he would give God a tenth of his possessions. He rolls back the well from the mouth. He asked, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" They said, "We know him." Verse 6, "Is he well?" "Yes." "Look, here's his daughter Rachel coming with the sheep." Well, he helps water the sheep. And finally, something clicks. Well, it didn't take long, apparently. You come down to verse 16. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Now, Leah's eyes were delicate. Not quite sure exactly what that means. Rachel, it says, was beautiful of form and appearance. Well, we've got some problems right off the bat, don't we? Now, Jacob loved Rachel. So he said, now, if you are married and you were thinking about getting married and preparing to get married and hoping it could be sooner, how long would be too long in your mind as you look back in your personal history? I don't think anybody's going to top Jacob. Laban said, it is better. Well, Jacob loved Rachel. He said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your daughter. I'm afraid that would be hard for people to understand in our culture. We've gotten used to everything instantaneously. And Laban said, it's better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Now you know the story, that Laban tricked him. Jacob's own tendency to be less than honest, think about his relationship with his brother Esau, came back on his own head. And he ended up serving not 7 years, but 14. And he had two wives. That could not have been a recipe for a happy home. Even some of the servants of God have made some not so good decisions, haven't they? Does it change the development of patience? What about Joseph? It's a long story, but there's one particular focus. First of all, turn to Genesis chapter 37. We'll go back even before his brothers sold him into slavery. Back to the dream thing. Joseph, Genesis 37, verse 5, Joseph had a dream. And he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said, please hear this dream which I've dreamed. Now you got to be thinking, how can you not see this will not end well? But he couldn't. He was an incredibly naive young man. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. Well, that doesn't take a whole lot to figure out, does it? And his brother said, will you reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. The dream was bad enough. Then you had to go and tell it to us. Then he dreamed still another dream, and he told that one to his brothers. Well, this fellow was not, at that point in his life, real quick on the uptake. And he said, look, I've dreamed another dream. This time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers. His father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers come to bow down to the earth before you? His brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. I find that interesting. That's just as a preface. Joseph had some indication. He apparently had some idea that this was a message from God. What would have been your thought or my thought if we got that as a young person of 16 or 17? Would have been cool. In a few months, in 6 months tops, I'll be ruling over my brothers. Didn't turn out that way, did it? You know the story. Chapter 39, chapter 40, he's in jail. He's in servitude first. Then he's not killed outright, but he's thrown in jail after he's falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. And it goes on and on and on. You could skim through chapter 40. Chapter 40 recounts the case where in the dream, the chief butler and the chief baker who were in the cell with him had dreams. So Joseph was He knew about dreams, and he figured God would help him. Sure enough, they told their dreams. Well, what he understood came to pass. Verse 21, Pharaoh restored the chief butler to his butlership again. He placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And remember, Joseph had specifically said, verse 14, remember me when it's well with you. Tell them I'm here unjustly. He must have thought, this is it. The patient days of waiting are done. We don't know how long it had been exactly. Some estimation is that he might have been, like Mr. Rushton was talking about Daniel and his three friends, might have been a teenager when he was sold into slavery. That's certainly the impression. 16, 17, we don't know. But he had been down there for over a decade, almost certainly. Most of it in jail, probably. And now it must have seemed like finally it was over. And 1 week went by, and a second week went by, and a month, and 2 months, and 6 months, and a year. Nothing happened. Finally, when it did, 2 years later, wow, did it ever happen fast. But Joseph learned patience the hard way, as a slave and as a slave in prison. And within a matter of an hour or two, probably, or a few hours at best, he was suddenly the second in command in Egypt. He was basically the prime minister of Egypt, or the vizier, the grand vizier under the Pharaoh. There's another story worth looking at. 1 Samuel chapter 1. The story of Hannah. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham. I practiced for an hour and a half on that verse, and it still didn't work. The son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, and Bohu apparently, the son of Zuth, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, the name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Eternal, were there. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife, to all her sons and daughters, we're not told how many. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Eternal had closed her womb. We're not sure of all the details, but she was unable to conceive. And because, of course, her husband had children by another wife, it was obvious the problem was with her. Her rival, there's a pretty good description of what happens in that kind of a household, provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. What do you think Hannah is having to learn to practice in this circumstance? Patience. Patience, patience, patience. Abiding under. And probably also long-suffering. So it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? This is the clueless of the year award in this verse. Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? What a guy. So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle. She was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, remember me. What does that say about her mindset? What was she thinking? That God had forgotten her. And not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Eternal all the days of his life. And the implication, perhaps he even had a vow, Nazarite vow for a time. No razor will come on his head. On the other hand, he certainly was involved in killing Agag, the king that Saul wouldn't, so perhaps that's not quite accurate. We don't know all the details. Hannah was a remarkable woman. And she was so remarkable that her son, the one promised, was one of the most amazing servants of God in the entire scripture. Samuel. A prophet and a judge. What about Simeon? No, not one of the sons of Jacob. Turn to Luke chapter 2. This Simeon. Luke 2, verse 21. When 8 days were completed for the circumcision of the child, his name was called Jesus, the name given by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. Now when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses were completed, they, meaning Joseph and Mary, brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. For as it is written in the law of the Lord, every male who opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. And to offer a sacrifice according to what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. And behold, there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. And this man was just and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel. And the Holy Spirit was upon him. That is, God's Spirit moved what he was about to say by inspiration. And it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. So he came by the Spirit into the temple. And when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him according to the custom of the law, he, Simeon, took him up in his arms and blessed God and said, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace. That conveys the idea of a long wait. The promise was he would not see death before he saw the Lord's Christ. Everything about it seems to indicate this was going to be a while. You know, you won't die until you see this promise fulfilled. And he immediately said, now I can go in peace. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared before the face of all peoples, to bring revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel. Those words were by inspiration and also quoted from parts of Isaiah. And Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. Then Simeon blessed them, and he said to Mary his mother, behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign which will be spoken against. Yes, a sword will pierce through your own soul also. That's how Christ died. That the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed. Then it begins to talk about Anna, who probably had a similar story of patience. We don't know how long Simeon waited, but it was an example of patience. And then there's the persistent widow in Luke 18, but we've covered that in so many other sermons and connections. But one of the verses involved in that, in Luke 18, does bear looking at. You know the story of how this widow just would not give up petitioning for justice. Finally, the judge caved in because, more than anything else, he wanted peace and didn't want to have to put up with it anymore. But in verse 6, then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him? That's a reference, an analogy, comparison to what the persistent widow was doing. Crying out day and night, waiting and waiting and waiting. Though he bears long with them. That's the aspect that God has of putting up with long suffering. What's the lesson for us? God bears long with us. We're to become like he is. We're to have the mind of Jesus Christ. She was patient. She was persistent. What about you? What about me? What's the point of all this? Let's go back to Jesus Christ's half-brother James to get an idea before we end for today. James chapter 1 now. Let's read just this one verse for the moment and think about it. James 1 verse 4. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Perfect can be translated, as the marginal reference gives in my Bible, as mature. Mature. This verse tells us where it all leads. God's family, that you may be perfect, spiritually mature and complete, lacking nothing. Interestingly, this verse is sandwiched in between two other big themes. The fact that trials are used to help us grow and produce patience, verses 2 and 3, count it all joy. You've read that many times. Probably have trouble understanding it every time you read it. When you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, let patience then have its perfect work. So that's one theme. And then verses 5 and 6 talk about asking God humbly for true wisdom in faith, knowing that only He can provide it. There's a lot there. James was a very down-to-earth sort of man. That's no surprise given who he was raised around. What's the point, brethren? Patience has an effect on us. I'm not talking now about how hard it is to build it. Patience, when practiced, has an effect. It is a refining effect. It is a chipping off of the rough edges effect. It is a smoothing out of the rough spots effect. It is a growth process. It's a spiritual maturation process. It changes us. It makes us more like our perfect role model, Jesus Christ. It grinds away the imperfections of human nature, helps us resist the pulls and temptations Satan can throw our way. And again, I'll make a plug for Friday Night Live. If you haven't watched it yet, please do. Mr. Horchak talks about what is the work of Satan. Very well done. But that refining effect of patience means it happens over time. Let patience have its perfect work ought to tell us that. Don't short-circuit the process. Don't bail on God before He's done with us. And as we learn patience and develop more of it, God is using it to grow something in us, to transform us, moving toward greater and greater spiritual maturity. Again, it says mature for the word perfect right here in James 1:4, marginal reference. We may not see it as it's happening. You know, you don't see changes that happen on a daily basis in people or in situations or in places. But if you've, let's say you go back where you grew up and you haven't been there for 20 years, you'll see changes. If you don't see people for 20 years, you'll see changes. I had an experience a few years ago, my wife and I, but she hadn't known this cousin of mine before. I had an experience of not seeing a cousin of mine for 60 years. The families became separated. And I had seen her at the age of just not quite 6. She was not quite 11. We connected again. I was just shy of 66, and she was just shy of 71. It's the only time I saw her again before her death, a year later. But I'm glad I had that experience. But she was different. Ooh, was she ever different? Me? Nah, not so sure. Okay. But it takes time. We don't see it as it's happening. We rely on His strength, God's Spirit, and we look to the examples we have, especially His sons. We live His way, and a transformation is taking place ever so gradually. Over the course of a lifetime in His calling, He's working in His children. The Master Potter is at work. He's at the wheel, molding and shaping and building like clay that is moldable, yielding to the hands of the artisan. But of course, that's the key. We have to be yielding. We are being formed in His image. And His purpose is that we are created as a vessel for honor, for eternity in His plan. Let's patiently let Him do His work in us.